Well, that's cool, baby. I mean, you know how it is, rocking and rolling and whatnot.
Hey, how's it going, eh? I'm Lee McCormick. This is Tramps Like Us, a Bruce Springsteen podcast sidecast, rocking and rolling and whatnot. Episode 14, Shout at the Devil 97 with Jimmy Lamort. I was recently a guest on a good friend of mine and guest of the show, BJ Cramp's podcast, Rock and or Roll, as part of a panel discussing Motley Crue's 1983 record, Shout at the Devil. BJ is doing a retrospective series on all the Motley albums. I encourage you to check out all those shows and BJ's great podcast. I have a connection with Motley's 1997 album, Generation Swine. One of my best friends, James Cavaluzzo, a.k.a. Jimmy Lamort, a.k.a. Little Buddy, worked on the track, Shout at the Devil 97. The crew decided to redo one of their classics and enlisted the assistance of Dave Rave Ogilvy and Jimmy. I've heard these stories before. I'm always picking Jimmy's brain about the time he worked with Motley Crue. But, you know, I thought it would be really cool to talk to Jimmy about working with the band, document the tale, put it out as a sidecast and a companion piece to BJ's Motley series. I encourage you to check out more of Jimmy's music via the website for his band Mal Havoc, malhavoc.com, that's MALHAVOC.com. As well, you can search the band Mal Havoc on Spotify for some more gems. There are even a few songs that I played on in there. As always, I appreciate you listening via the website, TrampsLikeUsPod.com, on Spotify or on iTunes. Be sure to check out the Facebook group page for more info and updates. Thanks to my buddy Jimmy for hanging with me, sharing these stories. He wasn't feeling well that night, so there's some coughing and there's some phlegm, there's some lozenge sucking and a few beer glass bangs. Sorry, that was my fault. But, you know, it all adds to the ambience of two buddies hanging out and talking about Shout at the Devil 97. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, we just, I don't know, there was just something about us that we always just wanted to piss people off, whether it was the way we looked or the way we sounded.
People's interpretations are weird. If they don't understand it, if they're ignorant of it, and they don't understand it, then it's evil.
Shout at the Devil was, you know, us kind of rebelling against ourselves, which would become a pattern that you would see for the rest of our career. I also think that it was us accidentally stepping into heavy metal.
You know, Nicky would make up these stories like he was playing the bass and then the pick would fly out of his hand and stick in the ceiling and release that. And people would go, oh my God, they're dabbling with the devil.
It was just being young and being rebellious, but we were trying to dig underneath the surface and find messages that we could spit back out. And for me, it was always about unifying a message that lots of people could identify with. You know, that's what it's about in an arena. You know, it's an anthem. Many people can scream the same word and all feel unified by that. I think that we're missing that right now a little bit. And Shout at the Devil was our opportunity to take that with things like Shout at the Devil. It was so simple using that word shout or using bastard and continually pounding that into the audience's head.
Shout!
BJ Cramp was doing this podcast series and he was doing like this retrospect on all the Motley records, right? So he had me on and we did like a roundtable discussion of Shout at the Devil. And he's going to go through all the albums and I guess he's going to do Generation Swine. So I'm like, oh, I got to talk to Jimmy about Generation Swine, right? So I'm here with James Cavaluzzo, a.k.a. Jimmy Lamort, a.k.a. Jimmy the Monkey Cavaluzzo, right?
The Monkey, yeah.
Yeah, you actually worked... You put together Shout 97, even though you probably didn't get the credit you deserved, right? But you pretty much put that song together, would you
say? Yeah, that was when I put it together, and Dave Rave Ogilvy mixed it.
Yeah.
Dave Rave Ogilvy was already hired on the sessions for Generation Swine. he was mixing. Dave Ray Ogilvy, you know, he's a producer, but what's his name was producing that record already?
Scott Humphries.
Yeah, Scott Humphries.
And where is he from? Do you know that? Have you heard that guy before?
Yeah, well, I knew him from Vancouver. He was assistant to Bob Rock, I believe.
He's kept with Bob Rock. Guy. Okay.
Yeah, he was, I think, assistant to Bob Rock, and he went on by himself.
So they probably knew them with the Bob Rock connection. And on the Motley 94 record they did with Karabi, I think Dave Ogilvy did a remix of Hooligan's Holiday.
Yeah, I have.
You ever heard that?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's pretty much the song, but then the middle part, it goes into this crazy part.
There's different mixes of it. You've heard the one mix of it, yeah.
Yeah, there's a 10-minute.
Yeah, there's different versions of it. I think he had a long-standing connection with the guys and crew. Yeah. Dave Ogilvy, I'm talking about, before even Hooligan's Holiday. Anyways, he was working in the sessions with, and I had been doing remixes with Ogilvy. We had just done, I think, the Tool remixes. I'm not sure if we'd done the Nine Inch Nails Monster Magnet yet. I don't think we had. Anyways, he had asked me to be assistant and help him do these remixes. And then he called me up and said, would you want to come down to L.A. and do a mix with Motley Crue? We met the Motley Crue. And I was just like, yeah.
Before we go further than that, what's your history with Motley Crue? Were you like a fan back in the early days at all?
I was one of their biggest fucking fans on the first album. Still to this day, is one of the greatest metal albums of all time.
Too Fast for Love, you're talking?
Yeah.
Love was out, me and John, my best buddy.
Yeah, Johnny Carrs has been on the show before.
We were in a band, All Havoc, and when those records came out, we were the biggest fans. When they released Shout the Devil, we went and lined up for, 6 hours just to get their autographs back at Sam the Record Man.
That was probably the third or fourth concert I went to. They played the Coliseum.
Yeah, around the corner. It's about 1,000 meters from here.
Yeah, where we are right now.
Yeah.
Lakeshore Boulevard here in Toronto.
So that was the first time I saw him, too.
It was June 84. I was there. I was like 10 years old. You're probably like a little bit older than you guys were like teenagers then, right?
Yeah, we were probably what? I can tell you, I remember a show that Devil came out. I tried dyeing my jean jacket from blue. I hated blue. I tried dyeing my jean jacket red. And
red,
the first band, I used to paint in watercolors on the back of the jacket. The first band I ever painted on the back of my red, attempted red jean jacket.
Yeah.
Was Motley Crue, and it was Shout the Devil.
Nice.
When it came out, and yeah, I probably wore it to the show and everything. So yeah, I was a huge, huge fan. But I mean, I thought they totally lost it after Shout the Devil. But whatever.
Yeah,
so it's so funny because I went to remix them. It was just like, you know,
not that I hated them. I still think their first album is still one of the greatest albums of all time. But I mean, I went there, you know, not knowing what to expect because their trajectory had changed completely.
They had gone right up to like Dr. Feelgood, where they were like top of the world, and then they'd kind of broken up with Vince, and they went down a notch, kind of with that 94 record.
But Dr. Feelgood, they were the number one band probably in the world, right?
Yeah.
And you know, what I liked and knew of them, there was way before Dr. Feelgood. But that's the thing is, some of the studio guys that I work with, and it's funny, they were all the guys. They were working on Generation Swine, almost, not all of them, but three of them I knew, and they were guys from the Feel Good days.
Yeah.
I mean, Scott and Paulo, or Paul DiCarli, and I forget the other guy's name, the mixer too. You know, and it was just weird seeing them, whatever, 20 years later, and I actually got to live with them and work on a record with them, which was it was pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah, that's cool, right? So you go through the 80s, 90s, like Mal Havoc, that's your thing, right? Like, so you start Mal Havoc, that band's kind of like a, how would you describe Mal Havoc? Like, kind of like a
metal, horror, industrial
kind of band?
I just wanted to make music that hadn't been made before, and I was totally a heavy metal kid. I got into hardcore, obviously.
It started with guitar, bass, drums, kind of thrash.
We were a thrash metal band, and then what happened was we recorded a record for a record label, and the record label made us pay for the album recording. So we did a record called Shrine, which is basically Age of Dark Renaissance with some orange songs on it. Age of Dark Renaissance, we're just now putting it out on vinyl. It should come out soon, which is our first recording.
Yeah, I gotta get that.
And then we didn't have a jam room anymore because we used to jam like most bands 5-6 nights a week, right?
It's fun, right? Yeah.
Well, we couldn't jam anymore because we had spent all our money on $3,000 of recording an album. And so all the money we used to put toward rent is now gone. So
you guys had a jam space?
Yeah, we had a jam space in Scarborough. And so we didn't have a jam space anymore. So I wanted to, obviously I was keep working on music, but without having a room to go to every night and work on music, I started getting into renting. MIDI was a new thing at the time. And so I had a drum machine and I got a synthesizer and a sampler, which was the first Mirage sampler. And I started working with these incorporating. I realized with samplers especially, you can incorporate sounds from horror movies into the actual song and use it musically.
Sex or the song. Sex. Sex or the song. Sex. Yes. Sex.
Experiment and writing songs with these weird things, knowing that nobody in heavy metal would ever done that. I mean, the drum machine was more of a thing that was just replacing my drummer because I didn't have a drummer.
Right.
But it was more about using
cause samples.
Yeah, because we were using tapes. We recorded tape on Age of Dark Renaissance. We were using tapes, and we didn't use synths in that all on the sort of introductions to the songs. But now I was trying to write songs, and the introductions were part of the songs. And not knowing that eventually they'd call it industrial music, which I think is a pretty far-fetched thing. I think Mojave's always trying to do it. I think Radiohead's one of the bands that perfected the exact cross between like modern electronic or robot music,
right?
Kraftwerk meets
techno,
Black Sabbath.
Rock,
yeah, you know, I wanted to do. Obviously, my biggest influence was heavy metal, and then prog even, and then I wanted to take it further.
And that's when I met you, like we're probably like 1990s, like the release era.
89, 90, yeah.
Yeah, that was awesome. Yeah. 35 years ago.
going, huh? It's not even a drop in the ocean. And if they're saying now that they found humans and that lived in Canada like 20,000 years before that fake Jesus Christ guy supposedly appeared.
Yeah, so in that 5 or 6 year period, I guess you progressed, you know, greatly, creative with, you know, using Pro Tools and the advancements in music, right? And
yeah, because we also had the help of, we had record labels wanting us to put out music, so obviously there's more push for us to make music.
You started like working at a studio, right? You're working with like Bobo.
Yeah, Rob Sanzo.
Yeah, so he would give you a space and you would like do little things with him on the side.
Yeah, that was the thing, it's early days I was working with the digital editing and recording music digitally, and that became the future of music.
Yeah.
And so someone like Rob, who I asked to record me, and he asked me to help him out because he saw I was already had my foot inside the door when it came to digital recording and digital editing, and I was working with him out of his studio doing some of this stuff.
Yeah, cool. So then it comes around to the Get Down record, and I guess that's when Dave Ogilvie comes in the picture, right?
Yeah, what happened is we were touring Premeditated Murder, our second album, full-length album, that got released. So it's actually our third full-length, or fourth if you want to count the EP that got released. We're touring across Canada, and we heard that Dave Ogilvie wanted to meet us, and obviously we were a huge fan. You know, he'd worked with so many bands, be it from Skinny Puppy, Grapes of Wrath, 5440, so many great Vancouver bands, but also international bands. He did some stuff with Bowie, he did some stuff with Einsters and Neubauten. He did so many great work, and he said he wanted to work with us, so we were like, yeah, we never had a producer or mixer, but we would have killed for the help of a producer or mixer.
Yeah.
So Ogilvie, I was around, 92, approached us and said, I want to work with you guys. So we started.
He came to you, you didn't go to him. That's
He came to us. He went and met him at Rocky Mountain. It's funny, Rocky Mountain just happens to be the place where a certain crew recorded.
Little Mountain Studios.
I'm sorry, Little Mountain Studios. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Little Mountain's part of Rocky Mountain. Is it not the same place?
I
think you maybe are right, but yeah, I went.
Yeah,
we went.
Did fucking Dr. Feelgood there, yes. Like Aerosmith.
And he showed us. He showed us the room where he recorded, where the drums for Dr. Feelgood and all that were done. At the time, they were working on a certain band called Metallica there. While we were there,
they did the Black Album there too.
They were mixing and sound editing and digitally editing Binge and Purge while we were there. The live box set that they released. So we were there to hang out with them. And then we made plans to work in the future. I'm not a singer. Don't ask me to sing. Music's just another field of books that put you in. Well, in my life, you may find some sense. And believing a liar only makes you dance. Now it's over. I'll begin again. It makes no difference. Just get on.
Shit. All right, so let's get down to this Shout 97. So this is like 96, I guess.
I don't even remember. Remember. All these years, I did about 3-4 years with Rave.
Yeah.
Between the two Mel Havoc records he did with me. I did two full lengths for me, Get Down and Lazarus Complex. And then I did the Tool remixes. We did remixes for Nine Inch Nails. We did remixes for Monster Magnet. And we did the Mott Crew remix.
Right. So where did you... It was in L.A., right? You flew in L.A.
Flew me down to L.A.
Remember what studio it was?
Oh, yeah. Oh, fuck. Now you gotta make... I should have looked this up to remember. it was in...
It wasn't like the...
I had the name of the studio. I have an article on the studio. It used to be where Death Row recorded all their albums at the Snoop Dogg records, the Dr. Dre records. Death records were there. And what happened is Suge Knight had just been thrown in jail. And so the studio basically was tied up the whole time by Death Row and Suge Knight. So the second Suge Knight went to jail, they had freedom to open the studio to other bands. But the studio had totally been reworked by Suge Knight. He basically came in gangster style and took it over, and they wanted to shut it down for a year and fix the place up rebuild some of the things that was stuff that Suge had changed and put it back to its original condition. And basically, I guess Scott or my crew knew about this, and they said, you know, instead of shutting down, you know, we'll take it as is. You don't have to fix anything. Yeah. And we'll work out there at a cheaper discount if you just give it to us straight up, I guess. I'm assuming. This is all assuming here because I don't know why they would take a studio that was in disrepair. But yeah, so they got in there, and then I went down there, and they were already mixing down the record. And I guess that what they realized is they had this, it was a double studio. It had a main studio live room and everything, and it had a B studio. And the funny thing is Dr. Dre and all the Suge Knight, or all the Death Row records were done in the B room. And the reason why they loved the B room is the B room had a raised floor with bag end speakers. It had like the most low end you probably ever heard in a mixing room.
Really? Oh, wow.
So Death Row recorded and used the B room to do all their sessions. So basically that live room hadn't been used other than orgies for like the last 5 or 10 years, right?
It's where they go to smoke. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So they were using the A room, and they thought, why don't we bring somebody to use it, do something in the B room, do something, maybe do something, you know, to, they, I don't know, but they knew that at the time, but they might have maybe had in the back of their head that maybe we could, you know, announce on live TV that we're making a comeback with the original band and use an old song.
And oh, because, so, okay, let's jump ahead, because they actually debuted this on the American Music Awards, which was like January 97, I want to say.
Yeah,
and that was the first appearance of the original band. Even,
that's
Vince.
Yeah, that's that another record. Great story was the fact they had no idea what they were going to do with what I was doing. It was basically Tommy Lee's idea that he wanted to modernize one old song. And basically when I showed up, Tommy Lee was all over it. Tommy Lee was the one, you could tell it was his idea.
You're like, we're gonna do this,
it's gonna be great, blah, blah, blah. And then what happens, they had trouble finding the 2-inch masters because they kept sending 2-inch master tapes to us. There were like live recordings from the Devil Tour.
When was the song picked? Like, when did you find
out? I knew before I went there. Well, I was so happy.
They want to do a show?
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't happy. Like, we want to remix Smoking in the Boys' Room or something.
Yeah.
Like
that. That's the thing is, so I got to admit, with Tool, we got to pick the songs.
Okay.
Monster Magnet, we got to pick the songs. Nine Inch Nails, he told me what song we had to do, which ticked me off because I didn't like that song.
Yeah.
And Motley Crue, they told us what song. I didn't mind because I liked that song.
Yeah, yeah.
And the funny thing is, they couldn't find. Like literally, I was there. I was supposed to be there. I was doing sessions in Toronto with a band, Mundane. I just said to them, "Hey, I just got a call from LA, and they want me to fly to LA to do a song for them."
Yeah.
I said, "Can I take a week off to go to LA and do a song, and I'll come right back?" And of course, they were like, "You know, we're not going to stop you. Yeah, yeah, go."
So but then, was it actually a tight week, or did you last? Was it?
Well, yeah, I actually just thought I was going to go there for a week and be back. Like, I thought, you know, that's how long we usually do. I did most of the remixes in 2 days, but we figure a week, you know, it's a Motley Crue, it's a big studio, it's a big gig. So I told them I'd probably be about a week, maybe 2 weeks at the most, right? Ended up, they didn't find the master tapes for 3 fucking weeks. Like, I was there, supposed to be there for a week, and then 3 weeks later, I'm still sitting there hanging on the couch
and they can't find nothing. The Motley Vault must be a fucking mess,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, totally. They could not.
Nothing, everything's mislabeled and shit.
They recorded
it's like
all.
Beer spilled all over it.
Yeah, they just recorded everything back in the day. It was all these live recordings, and we'd put it on. We'd get these 2 inches sent to us. We put it on the reel.
It would say shout in some live.
And then as soon as we hear it, we're like, the crowd noise, like, this isn't it. So it took them forever to find it. I'm so happy they did find it because, I mean, it wouldn't have turned out so well if we couldn't find the original tapes.
Elektra Records at that time, I'm going to expound on this because, you know what, those guys suck. And they were in the hole. We pulled them out of the hole. They made so much money that they became a big label again.
But so, by the time the tapes came, they were already wondering what the fuck I was doing. They thought, like, they were like ready to blame me. Like, who is this guy sleeping on our couch every day eating? Like, I was eating their leftover sushi every day. Like, they literally paid me $1,000 for the whole thing. It was through Dave Ogilvy. But like, Dave Ogilvy was in the A room, like helping them on the actual record. Yeah, like he
and here you are waiting around to do this remix.
He mixed the first single off the record. I think he mixed a couple other songs.
Yeah.
And so I'm in the B room, and they're like, you know, what are you? I'm like waiting for the record to come, and they're like, well, just fuck around. And it was cool because Tommy Lee was hanging out with me. I was working on this really good version with him of Piece of Your Action.
Really?
Like, just fucking around with Piece of Your Action. It was really cool.
Like, what, you just had it up on your computer,
like,
and you were just chopping it?
Yeah, I was chopping it and editing it like I did with all the other remixes, right? Because I love Piece of Your Action. It's like my favorite song. I told them that, right? So that's why I was doing it, right? And yeah, we were just fucking around and we were having fun. And we had some other jams that I did with Tommy Lee too that were just fucking around waiting for the tapes to arrive. And I wish to God, I wasn't allowed to walk out with anything, for those sessions are so important and big. And we're talking billionaires, club type stuff. So, yeah. You know, I didn't even think about walking out with some of that.
So you don't have it, you're like, you're goofing around mixing.
No, I don't have any of that. And the funniest one is, the funniest thing of all was Tommy Lee, the tapes finally came and we had already knew what tempo we had because we were working in the side room and that.
Yeah.
And so we did, we had the A room for an hour to record the drums, right?
Yeah.
And fucking Tommy Lee fucking nailed it in one fucking pass. Like, nailed it. And he broke his stick on the last snare hit. So they had to fix that. And they wanted the Pro Tool editor. They had, like, the Pro Tools, their recordings would go directly to Pro Tools.
Yeah.
They edit and then they send it to my room. But so while we were waiting there, Tommy's like, let's do some more passes. I'm like, well, you nailed it. He's like, I know, but I'm going to change it up.
I know, but come
on. Yeah, I want to do some more passes. So we did, I think, I'm pretty sure it was three more passes, but it could have been two with the original, which makes three passes. I do know there's three passes. And when you played all three drum passes together,
yeah.
It was the most mind... That was the moment when I realized Tommy Lee was probably the greatest... Well, he was definitely the greatest drummer I ever worked with.
Right.
Because when you played all three of those passes, like the last two I just recorded straight to my computer in stereo.
Yeah.
The first pass was recorded in like 16 channels to Pro Tools. And the last two passes, we just did to stereo. And when you put all fucking three passes together, it was mind-blowing because he was playing off each other's beat. And so when he played all three passes of drums on top of each other, yeah. It just sounded mind-blowing.
Like, oh, that's like, he's got in his head different sections, yeah. And he knows, okay, this verse I'm going to do this because I did this last time.
It's like he can
time.
Hear the original drumming, yeah. While he's drumming.
I did this last time, so this part, I'm going to do this. And
all
it fits, right?
All three passes, all he did was play to a click. And then the original, he didn't really play to a click. He actually, he had a Nord drum, and he made a pass of just the Nord drum that he had backing his original take. And then he did two more takes.
Yeah.
And it was completely mind-blowing. And I remember sitting there waiting for them to edit. And it was probably just an afternoon for them. And I remember I found this, like, two-bar loop of just him drumming, of just like doop doop da da doop da, just something simple like that,
yeah.
And it was just because they had the studio set up for the A room set up for like the album sound, the drum sound, yeah, for the main for Generation Swine, and so the drum sound was so fucking amazing. And I just remember there's probably a four-bar loop that he had that I would just play over and over.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, holy fuck. And I started, like, writing music around it. And I remember Ogilvy coming in the room and going, no.
You can't be fucking around with this stuff.
He's like, don't even think about it, Jimmy. Don't even think about taking that loop home.
And it
was the thing about it, too. It was just like, this wasn't stuff that was recorded for the song. This was just bonus shit fucking around with me. And they were like, they were worried that I would take it home because it was so fucking good.
So then the master tapes finally show up?
Well, I mean, the master tapes showed up, and then that's when we did the drum pass.
Okay, so what was the... Like, did you have a game plan in mind of how you're going to arrange this, or were they in your head saying, we want to do it this way?
Tommy Lee had done the arrangement.
We want to arrange
but
it
by the
way.
Time I finished it, I fucked with his arrangement a little bit.
All right.
Not much. I added more bars at the end because I came up with that riff at the end with Mick Mars, and so we extended that ending a little bit. But it's pretty much the way Tommy Lee, but it's still the same arrangement.
Yeah.
It's just a different speed. Right. That's the one thing that Tommy wanted, was a much faster speed.
So I noticed on the version that, like, it seems like all the music has been re-recorded, but the vocals are the original vocals. So was Vince, like, not around at all?
Okay, so you want, am I allowed to, I don't know, now we're getting to areas where I'm even not allowed to talk.
Well, this is 22 this. Years ago, or 23 years ago.
Yeah,
man,
but
so.
Basically... I don't want to get into details about that, but I just ended up using the original vocals. I think the original vocals made more sense because it sounded and made the whole mix. The only thing we
brought it together because, like, oh, this is, I hear that.
Pretty much
mix.
Everything on that remix was new except the vocals. And
I know what, can I guess?
Yeah,
the guitar lick on the outro,
I just sped both those up.
Really?
Yeah, and I just dropped
him in. So you sped his vocals up a bit.
Yeah.
And it's hard to...
But, I mean, I didn't pitch it up. I sped it up using, you know, Pro Tools.
Oh,
and same with the guitars,
to, like,
yeah. And I dropped him in. And I had to, like, you know, do some fine tuning to make it sound good or
certain
whatever.
Sections, yeah.
But, yeah, that's the only two things to the original. But I think because of that we use the original vocals, it sounds very much like the original song.
Yeah. So were you actually... I guess it was you and Dave that were recording... like Nicky, Mick, and Tom on their parts? Were you like in the studio while they were doing that? Tell me about that.
The one thing that Dave would leave me alone, but the one thing he'd always sit in on, obviously, was the actual recordings. Like he was there when Tommy did the passes and the drums, and then he would let me do all the editing in that. And I'd
what order did it go? The little drums, oh, yeah, bass, drums, guitar, or drums?
Drums, bass, exactly. Yeah. Drums, bass, guitar, right. And then we throw the vocals
right,
on.
Right, right, right.
And then when Tom, it's so funny. I mean, again, I don't know how much I should get in detail here, but when Nicky came
they're,
in.
They're broken up, man. They're not a band anymore.
When
they don't
Nicky
give a fuck.
Came in, I love, like, that's the thing is, when I first met them the first 3 weeks there, I was a little hesitant because I saw the, you know, I saw the bit of higher than that, holier than thou attitude that they had. They were better than everyone else. But then after a bit of time hanging out with them, like, they were very friendly to me and I got to know them really well. And I began to realize that they had no sense of the outside world whatsoever. Their box was so enclosed. Like I used to say to them, oh, there's a concert tonight in LA. Do you guys want to go? And they would say, oh, I'd go, but you got to tell me 3 days in advance because I got to arrange it with the club. And then I realized their lives are so sheltered and it's not because of something they chose. It's something that's forced upon them because of their celebrity.
And they're in LA where it's always in their face. And
yeah, and over time I got to like them more. When I first went there, I was a little bit, you know, how back I said, oh yeah, they've totally become rock stars. They're out of touch with the world. But then I began to realize that they're forced into this situation and, you know, and we really became really close friends. By the end of the 3 weeks, but before we even started the sessions, we became, me and Tommy Lee and Mick became really, really good friends. And I was very open to them, more so than, they had all these people around them who were just like, yeah, that's great. And I was the one guy that was saying, dude, that's not cool. You know? And that's the other thing, is some of the guys
that's a fine line, because that can either go one way or the other, right? Yeah. They can either love you or they can hate you.
And the other thing that was very interesting is they were all just, you know, not all, but certain ones were just out of rehab, and they let, for some reason, they let me and Ogilvy in our room do what we wanted to do. And so
that's what I was going to ask, like, weren't they like drinking or drugging around during that time?
We weren't doing it in front of them, but I didn't realize until like halfway through the session that they weren't allowed to do it. Tommy came in one day and he's like, oh, I love that smell. And I was just like, well, what,
are you smoking weed or something?
Yeah, and I'm like, well, you know, do you want to smoke? He's like, oh, no. I'm totally clean. I can't. And he's like, but I do like it coming in and smelling it. And yeah, and so some of the, because they had a B room and we wouldn't bother them in the A room, so much Ray's friends and probably Crew's friend. I just remember the guy from Rob Zombie and Nine Inch Nails used to come. That was one of the things that bothered me at the beginning. Is they would have the rock star friends come. They'd always hang out in my room because I'm in the B room, right? So they couldn't get in trouble for having your friends hang in the A room. And they were doing all these stupid jokes on me. They were treating me like a newbie. Well, I'm a newbie in the sense that I was new to them.
This is the guy we can pick on. Cause...
Yeah, they were picking on me like crazy when I first went there. They had a Polaroid camera and they kept putting pictures of their penises on my computer and stuff like this. Yeah. And it's just like, come on, guys. Like, this isn't, like, it's just so petty and juvenile. And they thought it was hilarious and all that.
No, we were just stupid kids from L.A., man. We weren't anything. You know, we were just in awe of the whole thing.
And yeah, I mean, I still got all these penis pictures from them and whatever. But, I mean, over time, I got the sense of, you know, why. It's only that.
When you write the autobiography, now you got, like, photos now.
Yeah, of these photos, yeah. And then they're going to sue me for printing pictures of their penises.
Were there chicks hanging around? Tommy was with Pamela there. Nicky was with Donna. Did they ever show up?
The first person I met when I went out, when I arrived at the studio was actually Pamela and their kid.
Really?
Yeah. She was there. So, yeah, it was a different type of session. They were both married. And they both were clean. And that's why it's one of the funny things is we'll get there. But when they heard the work, when I finished the song for them, they basically asked me to stay longer. And to this day, I wish I stayed.
I wonder what could have changed, right?
Yeah.
where the road would have turned, right?
Yeah, they're no longer fresh out of rehab anymore. And they went on to do those tours. And they kept doing my version of the song, which I found interesting.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, they like it's in, you know what? Like every tour since that record came out, they played your version of the song, except for one.
Except the very last one, yeah.
No, the very last one they did that you arranged.
Oh, they did.
Yeah, the only tour they didn't do, which speaks to why Tommy was in your ear, was the New Tattoo tour where Tommy left the band.
Oh.
And they had Samantha Maloney from Hole played on the tour. They went back to the shout version, the original album version.
The slower version, yeah.
But then when Tommy came back, 2005, it was like shout 97 all the way
to
the end.
Wow, I didn't know that. I thought at one point they changed after 10 years and they played the older version.
Well, it must have been Tommy's like, I'm not playing that song unless we're doing
the new version.
Jimmy's version.
Well, I don't mean to brag, but I do think the new version is way better.
I gotta admit, like, I do love the remix, you know, and that's saying something because, like, Shadow of the Devil, the original album and the original song, is like one of my favorite records and songs ever. You know, so you know, I love both versions. I love the verses on the original with the like with all the drum bits and the stops and the phrasing and stuff like that that Tommy's doing. But there's there's just like so much energy in the remix. And yeah. I think that's why they do it live.
Well, that's fucking really, yeah. That's what I wanted, and I think what Tommy wanted. I think that's what all everybody wanted. They wanted that energy,
yeah.
That to push it. They wanted to push. You know them. They're full volume all the time. And that's the vibe I got from them. That's what I was lucky enough to capture. I was gonna say one of the fun things I was telling you about was when Nicky came in. He didn't remember. I guess they hadn't been on the road. They hadn't played Shut the Devil live, and so he was trying to remember how to play the guitar. Me and Rave were recording everything he did, and then he had to take an important phone call, and he's like, okay, I'll be back in a second.
His bass.
Yeah, it's doing his bass. He's trying to remember how to play the song. He couldn't remember how to play it, right? Because we just had the drums down. We didn't have anything but the drums, right? So we needed him.
So you're like playing top of it. It was like, oh, I forget this,
right? Yeah, he's trying to remember as he's playing it, right? And because I've done digital editing for so long at this point, he went and took his phone call, and he comes back. He's like, okay, guys, I got it. I know I can nail it now. He's like, I'm going to nail it.
Yeah.
And we're like, we don't need you anymore, Nicky. He's like, what are you talking about? And I hit play, and I had edited from all his attempts to play.
And you arranged it and chopped it up.
Yeah, I chopped it up and cheated, did it all. Cheated, yeah.
You cheated.
It was fucking hilarious. I'm like, listen.
Was he cool then? Yeah. He's like, fucking go for it. Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, it was done.
I sound fucking
And the
great.
Funny thing is that Mick was a completely different story because Mick knew how to play it.
Yeah.
But Mick did not want to play it. Mick thought the idea of a remix, remixing one of his songs,
yeah,
was just
ridiculous.
Yeah, it was insulting.
Right.
So it was really hard to get him to play. And me and Ogilvy were really, I mean, that's the thing is, I think he realized in time that me and Ogilvy were on his side, obviously. Yeah. And then the best part, my favorite part working with Mick was he did a slide at the end.
Let me tell you, I have this in my notes, man. I think the third verse, there's a part and the drums break. Drop out. He does a
I caught that moment. I remember I caught that when he was farting around, because again he was pretending like, you know, whatever, and I could tell that, you know, it was like he didn't want to do it. And I caught a slide, and I was like, dude, I was like, that's like the fucking nicest fucking slide. And that's the thing is, me and Rave were on that, like trying to get him into it by telling him shit like, dude, you're one of the best guitarists, like, man. Now, I told him shit like that. I totally think that
we were talking about guitar tone earlier. Yeah, let me tell you about Mick Mars' guitar tone. Holy
I told
shit, right?
him that the first fucking Too Fast for Love is one of the greatest guitar metal, his guitar playing, everything about that tone, guitar tone, everything about his guitar playing on that record is totally one of my favorite things. So we were buttering him up, and we finally got him into it. And I remember at the end, another time he you know, didn't want to play it, he stopped playing, and he did a little off-time thing.
Yeah.
I said, oh man, I caught that. If you put that in, and again, I'd play back their mistakes to them. And say, like, you know, the doom dan 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 doom dan 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 dan. Said you can play that like a riff. Like, you sort of did it off time by mistake when you were stopped playing. Yeah, I'm like, I said, play it that thing like a riff, like dan 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 dan. And he played it, and it was just like, well, dude,
that's the song.
We are extending the ending now because, like, that riff is, like, it works bananas.
Yeah.
And so by the end of it, it's funny, at the beginning, he didn't want to come in the room and do it. And by the end of it, he didn't want to leave.
Yeah, he was getting into it. That's awesome. Cool. You know what I want to do? Do you want to play the song and, like, talk over? Let's play the song and, like, do some, like, commentary on top of it. All right, so let's check this song out here.
Okay.
So that's guitar there.
This is the funniest thing about the whole record. That sound you're hearing right there?
Yeah.
I had made the engineers, the guys that work the studio, carry in a wall-sized modular move into my studio from a studio.
Yeah.
Just so I could do that beginning. That whole beginning was a move being filtered, filtering the bass.
What's the bass?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
I was move filtering the bass and echo and all that.
Yeah.
And the guys in the studio will never forgive me for that. Now, the crazy thing about this right now is you can't hear. There's actually two drum kits playing. Like I said, Tommy had programmed the Nord drum kit. That's one thing that bothered me. I wasn't there for the mix. And it's actually more of the mastering. It was there in the mix, but the mastering, there's so much compression happening that you don't really hear the other drumming.
But that's two takes on the drums.
No, he did a take of just drum machine.
Oh, okay.
And he played on top of it a real take.
I got you.
So there, see all those little things in between the riffs are things that I dropped in like dun 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 dun. That was all things that I dropped in. And the funny thing is, like, most of them weren't played. They were like mistakes
that you put in there.
That I put in there.
So they must have been listening back to it and go, oh, that's that mistake I made. And they're, oh, now it's part of the song.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Well, they didn't even know, because I was recording everything. Like, when they stopped playing in that, they would be putting the guitar down and stuff. And it was still,
like,
yeah,
sound.
Oh, yeah.
That's amazing.
And especially that groove there, that doo-doo. And then there's a part coming up now where we used a change leg. Here it is. Oh, wait, that part. Okay, that part.
So this would have been the guitar solo in the original, and yeah, mixed like a, just basically a riff part here you got going on.
No, he must have played that. That was, he must have
here's
that,
here's
play
that,
that
slide we were talking about. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So green, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's so ridiculous. Like, all that stuff, that do-do-do-do-do,
yeah.
I added all that.
It's obvious it's the original vocals, though. Like, first
oh, yeah,
time I heard it, I'm like, oh,
it sounds great, yeah. I can't believe how good it sounds. Like, the vocals are really up front, but I guess that's pop music.
Yeah.
And we added the break here. So probably two things we changed is this break here and the ending from the original arrangement that
right.
Tommy Lee had thrown down. I really like the... this breakdown here, and I reversed the vocals here. I reversed the backing vocals. Yeah, so the backing vocals are original too. Yeah, again, I did that. Again, that was Tommy Lee. Sorry, that was a Nicky Six fucking around, and
yeah,
I kept it.
Put it
in. Yeah, he's like, "Fuck, what?" And I'm like,
"Here's
yeah.
that."
And that's
outro
the
lift.
Other. Yeah, that's the outro
yeah,
lift.
Love
exactly.
It. Makes the song right.
Yeah, exactly from the Werner session, from the original session.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was so funny because I remember what happened was I had been there probably 4 weeks at this time,
yeah,
and they still hadn't heard anything. And even the guys like Mick Mars and Tommy, or sorry, even Tommy Lee only heard it with his drumming, right?
Yeah.
And Nicky Six didn't even remember how to play it, so he never even had a clue what it sounded like.
Yeah.
Mick Mars just did it bit by bit because he didn't want to do it, right?
Right.
And so they none of the guys had a clue after 4 weeks what the fuck I was doing in that room, right? And I just remember Dave Rave, because he was in the, like I said, he was in the A room helping with the record. And
yeah,
he came to me one day. He's like, dude, he's like, have you got it finished? I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty close to finish. I'm pretty close to finish. He's like, we got to get a mix going up in the next 2-3 hours because the lawyers and management guy, the boss, the manager's coming by tonight. And they don't know what the fuck you're doing here.
They
want to hear what the fuck.
They want an excuse for why we're paying you.
Yeah,
why you're,
well, yeah. And the thing is, they didn't give me much money.
Yeah.
And I was living off leftovers. But anyways, they wanted to send me home. And so we had to play on the mix. And the funniest thing of ever is the guys, because they were in the A studio at the time, the kids that ran the studio, I forget what did you call them. They're not really engineers, but they're the kids that ran everything. They
yeah.
didn't know how to hook up the mix to the volume, so we had to play it at full volume and like the loudest fucking
to the
studio
suits.
Yeah, to the suits.
What were the suits like? Were they like old guys or young guys in suits or
lawyers, managers?
They were,
yeah. There was about it, what happened is Tommy and Mick came in and they said, okay, we need to hear what you're doing.
Okay, well, I wanted to ask you this. When was the first time the band heard the mix?
This is it.
The same time with the suits as well?
Yes.
Ah.
It was just not the band. It was just Tommy and Nick, and they came in and said, we want to hear what you're doing. And this is literally 2 days before the announcement on the AMC Awards.
Wow.
2 days before the announcement on the AMC
so
Awards.
So that's kind of a big moment for you there, I guess, eh?
Well, I didn't know. I didn't care because I knew I knew I wasn't ripping them off. I
yeah.
knew I wasn't there stealing from them. I knew that I was there to help them.
I was
them.
Doing work.
Yeah,
on
I was working. And then we only had the tapes maybe 2 days before.
Yeah.
This is all, everything came together in like 2 days.
The reason
you
were there for 4 weeks is because someone fucked up and couldn't
yeah,
find the master.
Yeah, exactly. So anyways, they came in and they didn't know what they were in for. And I, you know, and I was just like finishing. I was literally just putting the finishing touches on. And Rave never really had the mix up. He pretty much brought the faders up. And he did a good hour of fine. Because Rave, that's where Rave is a god. He's a great mixer and also great producer. He can correct things that just sound wrong.
Right.
Anyways, we worked on it really hard for a couple hours. They came in and we had to sit there with the volume. I couldn't plug my ears because like that would be
it would look like
yeah
like,
bad.
You gotta be looking.
So
yeah,
it was really fucking loud. And they played and literally when the song ended, their jaws were on the ground. And that's when Nicky Six applauded, walked up to me, and took off the bracelet off his arm
yes.
and gave me his bracelet. And
oh.
he said, I think you deserve this.
Oh my God, that's fucking
and they
amazing.
Were, they just couldn't stop the chatter in the room. Like, just like, oh my God, that's so good, that's so good. And I think right there on the spot, within an hour
wow,
of them hearing the song, they were like, you know what? us to do this on the American Music Awards in two nights.
Who said that?
I mean, that's what they were all talking about. They were all talking about it, and they said, we got to do this. They never said it while I was in the room. They left the room, but then they came back to me later that day, and they said, guess what? Tomorrow, we're going to do a mix of this tonight. They're going to take the mix to a rehearsal. Maybe they're rehearsing. I'm not sure if they're rehearsing. I think they went to rehearsal space, and they rehearsed it for a full day, lip-syncing to that.
Right.
And then they lip synced it on the American Music Awards. And this is the thing that really amazes me.
So that was right around when you were working with them. So that would have been January.
It was the same time.
Listen, so that was January 97.
Let me finish the story. Okay. The next day, they told me they were doing it and all that, and they're going to rehearse it and all that. And they said to me, we want you to come with us in our limo, and we want you to be standing side stage when we do your song on network television. Man.
But that never happened, though, right?
My girlfriend was there waiting for me to come home because she came, and I was supposed to be there for a week, and then she came after like 3 weeks, and she was there, and she's like, we got to go home. Like, this was like around Christmas.
Right.
And I was like, dudes, I got to go home. After I played in the mix, they were begging me to stay. I think it might have been more than 2 days. It probably would have been 3 or 4 days later.
I got the date here. The American Music Awards was January 24th, 97. So, like, actually, exactly 22 years ago tonight was when that they played that.
Wow, weird.
Yeah, so the album came out in June.
That's crazy. This is the anniversary.
Yeah, exactly. On this day, this was not planned.
And this was the saddest moment in my life because I actually flew home on the 24th.
And you watched it on TV.
Yes, we landed. We ran home. We put it on TV. We watched it live. And I remember, I've seen videos of it. He put a sticker on his guitar that says Jimmy something something.
Really?
Maybe Jimmy the Monkey, it says on his guitar. Yeah. And you can see it on his bass.
Because your credit on the record is Jimmy the Monkey.
Yeah, they just gave me a credit for doing some additional,
it said, things, yeah, additional chopping, which is
different chopping, yeah. But yeah, basically, that's all I did with the remix. They wanted me to do more work on the record, but I had to leave, and they asked me to listen to some other songs. They played me a couple other songs for dinner. She's fine. They wanted me to add synth parts to it. I think I added synth to one other part, but I know they didn't use it because it sucked. Because that was more, I mean, I'd been there, and I was a little bit pissed that they had asked me to stay, and I couldn't stay, and I was making all these decisions about going home. Should I go home? And everything. But yeah,
wow, that's cool, man.
And I mean, I wish to this day, it's very sad because, like, then I lost my computer, I lost contact with them, and then it was so weird that I ran into them years later, and they were shocked that I still wear Nikki's bracelet. They thought that
wearing it tonight. That's it's like about 12 skulls, like, connected bracelet kind of thing, right? Yeah. It's all pure silver.
And that's the thing, is like, it's so funny, I ran
you've been wearing that thing since 97. How many times have you lost it? You've lost it a few
times.
Only
once. It's a long story. I won't get into it.
Okay.
That's pretty awesome. I lost it once, and it came back to me. And that's the thing. A lot of people, I couldn't believe I ran into them a couple years later to promote Generation Swine, and they were shocked. And I'm like, why would they be shocked? They actually thought, like, I just did it for money. That's the reason why they're shocked. They thought that I was, like, a big studio guy in Canada. And then they came, they saw that I was working at a record store. They were doing an autograph session.
Well, I was there for that. They were H&B Greatest Hits. They were there. So we were.
And they were shocked. It's so funny because everybody at my work thought I was making the story up about working with them.
And then they were there, and you had some contact with them?
Yeah, and then when they walked in, the first one that recognized me was Tommy Lee. He's like, Jimmy the Monkey, what are you doing here?
What are you doing here,
dude? Yeah, and they were going to take me in. All these stories about them wanting to hang out with me, and it's just bad timing and shit. It never worked out, and I lost their numbers and all that. And I wish to God I stayed in touch with them and not lost their numbers.
I remember they played, they were doing Generation Swine, like a club tour, a promo tour, and they played the Warehouse here, the RPM, and we tried to go, and remember we couldn't get in or something like that.
We went to the door, there was like five of us, and we didn't. I couldn't believe it. That's the thing, is like, here I was, if it wasn't for me, I mean, it was Tommy Lee's idea, it was pretty much me that put it all together. And, like, you know, Rave was also one much responsible. But then to go to their shows, and I remember the one time they did give me tickets, there were, like, obstructed seats off to the side at Massey Hall. And it's just like, yeah. And that's the thing, is, like, part of the reason why I got turned off by the music industry was just, I don't regret doing it at all, but it's just like, you know, their people around them were such assholes, they wanted to send me home. And it wasn't, all I was doing was, like, sleeping on a couch and eating their leftovers. So how is that a problem?
But anyway, man, that's awesome. That's it's so cool that you did that, and I'm like 1 degree connection to Motley Crue, man. Like, one of my best buddies. Like,
and it's so funny because people think, you ask me, you know, what's the? That's like, yeah, I think maybe the Tool remix, but for sure the Motley Crue remix may be the best work I've ever done.
Well, there's that Generation Swine could be their worst record, and that's not say anything about that song because that song shines on that record. That's probably
well, just the fact that they would tour for another 10 years and
play that thing. Yeah, absolutely. All right, man. So thanks for talking with me about this, James. Thanks for giving me all the details on this. I knew most of them, but...
No problem, sick dog.
Yeah, you know, it's cool, man. So what's going on with Mal Havoc? Do you want to plug anything? You got some Mal Havoc stuff coming up for the
people? Yeah, I've been working on stuff. I'm trying to get my shit together. It's really hard right
now.
Yeah,
it's hard.
I had a few court dates, and I'm now cleared. No longer have criminal cases before the court, so...
So we're ready to rock coming up?
I'm ready to rock now, and I'm going to hopefully... You know, I'm probably going to probably release singles at a time digitally. Yeah. And do it through our website. MalHavoc.com is our website. Oh, check, go there to buy our music if you want to check out our music.
Yeah, check out the, what was the one I worked on with you with? The Cronenberg one?
Yeah, there's a lot of demos also on SoundCloud. The stuff that you worked on, a lot of it is on SoundCloud. The one song is Human Fly, you can get on.
Human Fly I played on. We did Clones. We did about 5 or 6 gigs there. But when was that? That was like early 2000s. Yeah. Good times, man. All right, so thanks, Jimmy the Monkey Cavaluzzo. All right, rock on. Show to the Devil 97.
That's the show, friends. Thanks for listening. You can find us on our website, TrampsLikeUsPod.com, communicate with us on Facebook, on our Tramps Like Us podcast group page, and on Twitter, at TrampsLikeUsPod. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on iTunes, where you can leave a review and a 5-star rating. Rockin' and Rollin' and Whatnot Sidecast is a nonprofit audio fanzine created by fans for fans and is available for free. We are not affiliated with Bruce Springsteen or any of the artists featured on the show. If you have heard any music you like, please find it and purchase it via iTunes, Amazon, your local record store, or wherever music is sold. As always, gratitude and respect to all of the great musicians and performers we feature on the show. Stay cool and keep rocking and rolling and whatnot.
Reason why we put it right out here and we said, look at this. There's a pentagram. But why don't you read? Well, we're telling these religious fanatics, read this. Shout at the devil. It doesn't say shout with the devil. It's at the devil. And that's why we put the pentagram right on the front.
And a lot of things, if you stand in the middle of it, the evil can't get into you. Right. So it's actually a good symbol.